A week has now passed since the last of the Whitechapel murders took place. During that period, there has been something more than the customary show of police activity. The coroner has done as much as it lies in the power of a coroner to do to probe the mystery. Yet not the smallest approach appears to have been made towards the apprehension of the criminal. No trustworthy clue has been obtained. We assume that the police have done their best, and we are far from charging them with incapacity, because their best amounts only to failure. They have not arrested any man against whom a reasonable case could be made. But they have arrested more than one whom there never was the faintest warrant for suspecting. We express our surprise that the police have pounced on persons who were plainly innocent. That they have not succeeded in arresting the culprit is a pity. But they have been energetic in the wrong direction is distinctly a reproach. There is a worse thing than doing nothing. That is, doing something that ought not to be done. Pall Mall Gazette, 15th September, 1888.
You are now entering London's East End to experience the Autumn of Terror. Please note that this episode contains adult themes and descriptions of violent crimes, which may not be suitable for all audiences. The use of the term prostitution is in no way intended to cause offence, but it will be used in this series for historical accuracy, as that is what it was referred to back then. Primary sources have been used as much as possible. This series has been created with the utmost respect for the victims in mind.
Hello and welcome to Prasher's Murder Map. This is episode 4 of my 7-part Jack the Ripper series. I'm just on my way to the Ten Bells, one of the most famous pubs in Whitechapel history. It's been around since 1752, and they even changed its name for a while in the 1970s and 80s to the Jack the Ripper. In 1988 it went back to being known as the Ten Bells. At least two of the Ripper's victims were thought to have drunk here shortly before their deaths, and on the wall opposite the bar is a sign listing the names of the victims. Let's go inside.
Evening. What can I do for you?
I'll have a lemonade, please. So there's six names on the sign at the back. Martha Tabram, Mary Ann Nichols, known as Polly, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly. We've already talked about Martha Tabram and the controversy over whether she really was a Ripper victim, but there's another name on this list which also sparks debate.
Which one's that then?
Liz Stride, do you know the story?
No, I haven't been working in this area long. Tell you what, it's a slow night. Why don't you tell me about it?
Why not? My listeners are going to come in to hear Liz's story too, if that's all right.
Of course. Come on in, everyone. You're not going to start this story on a typical dark and foggy night, are you?
Actually, the foggy night thing is a myth. The image of Jack the Ripper as a dark figure stalking the Whitechapel streets, clutching a Gladstone bag with the gaslights barely piercing through the thick fog, might be compelling, but it's not true. None of the murders took place on a foggy night, and on the day of this one, it was wet and windy. Before we get started, I'd like to say a big thank you to Peter Blexley, author and former Scotland Yard detective, who is voicing the character of Detective Inspector Edmund Reed. Peter is very well known, has consulted on numerous documentaries and TV programmes, and was one of the founder members of Scotland Yard's undercover unit in the 80s. So be sure to listen out for his appearance, and I'll put some links in the show notes to his books and social media. He'll also be back in episode 7. You might remember at the end of the last episode, we'd just heard about the Dear Boss letter received by the Central News Agency. Hitherto known only as the Whitechapel Murderer, or the Whitechapel Fiend, the killer had now given himself an electrifying name, Jack the Ripper. Or had he? The letter was written neatly and by someone with a good education, so suspicions would later fall upon a journalist. After all, Why would it even cross the mind of a murderer in those days to write a letter to the press? The idea isn't alien to us nowadays, with other notable examples like the Zodiac and his ciphers planted firmly in the history books, and shows like CSI and Criminal Minds to tantalise the imagination. But back in Victorian times, there was no concept of a serial killer, and such an egregious, bloodthirsty name seems more likely to have sprung from the pen of someone keen to benefit from a sensational scoop. At first, police were sceptical and believed the letter to be a hoax. But when the terrible events of Sunday, 30th of September, 1888 came to light, they began to wonder if it really could have been written by the killer. Just 3 weeks had passed since the brutal murder and mutilation of Annie Chapman at 29 Hanbury Street, and tensions were running higher than ever. At 12:45 a.m, a Hungarian Jew named Israel Swartz was walking down Berner Street on his way home, just half a mile from the scene of the last murder. Berner Street was mostly a residential road, and between number 40, which was the International Working Men's Educational Club, and number 42, was a narrow yard called Duffield's Yard. Nowadays, Berner Street has been named Henrique Street, after a local benefactor, and the houses have been replaced by a school. Swartz noticed two people standing at the entrance to Duffield's Yard. A man was trying to pull a woman into the street, then threw her to the ground. She screamed three times, although not loudly. The assailant was around 5'5", 30 years old, broad-shouldered, fair-complexioned, with dark hair and a small brown moustache. He was wearing a black overcoat and a black felt hat with a wide brim. Not wanting any trouble, Swartz crossed to the opposite side of the road. He may have perceived the incident as a domestic argument. In those days, if a man and woman were having a physical altercation in public, and the man announced she was his wife, that would be all it took for passers-bys to ignore it. Apparently, it wasn't acceptable for a man to assault a stranger, but it was perfectly fine if it was his wife. Swartz heard the broad-shouldered man shout, "Lipsky!" This was a racial slur towards Jews, following the murder the previous year of a woman called Miriam Angel just a block away, by Jewish umbrella salesman Israel Lipsky, who was hanged for the crime. Due to the derogatory nature of this term, it's highly likely that whoever said it was not Jewish themselves. On the side of the pavement that Swartz had moved to, a man of around 6 foot, 35 years old with light brown hair, wearing a dark overcoat and a hard felt wide-brimmed hat and holding a clay pipe, emerged from a doorway on the sidewalk near Nelson's public house. Some of you might know I'm a bit of a movie buff, so this reminds me of The Third Man, starring Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles, when Harry Lime steps out of a doorway. Swartz walked quickly away, followed by the tall man with the clay pipe, although he wasn't sure if he was pursuing him or just walking in the same direction. Swartz didn't know who the shout of Lipsky was directed at, and it could even have been someone shouting the name Lizzie, and he had misheard. He also wasn't sure if the two men knew each other or not. Just a few minutes later, Louis Diemschutz, steward of the International Working Men's Educational Club and jewellery salesman, on his way home from a day at the market, arrived at Duffield's Yard in his pony and trap. The gates to the Working Men's Club were open, and he would have seen a chink of light coming from the windows and the welcoming sounds of singing and laughter from inside. There'd been about 100 people there earlier that evening, attending a lecture on why Jews should be socialists. It was a two-story wooden building that looked a bit like a barn, and inside was a stage where amateurs performed plays, often by Russian revolutionaries. It was frequented by Russians, Jews, British, French, Italian, Czech, and Polish radicals. By this time, many of the club members had left, except for about 28 men who were still singing and talking. Diemschutz's pony shied, as if startled by something. Horses have better night vision than humans, and a keener sense of smell, so the animal was the first to detect that something was wrong. It was oppressively dark, so Deemschutz used his whip to poke around the area, then lit a match to shed a tiny flicker of illumination over the scene. He flinched when he saw a body on the ground, but at first he thought it was his wife lying drunk on the floor, presumably not an unusual occurrence. But when he looked closer, he was confronted with a hair-raising shock. It wasn't a drunk woman at all. It was a dead one. He went into the working men's club and asked for help. Two men, Morris Eagle, who had been leading that night's political debate, and Isaac Kozabrodsky, went outside and saw the woman lying in a river of blood, a stream of it trickling down the yard. Eagle ran down Commercial Street, while Deemschutz ran down Fairclough Street, both shouting for a policeman. Constables Lamb and Collins arrived at the scene, pushing back a rapidly gathering crowd of people, desperate for a glimpse. PC William Smith also arrived, passing through Berners Street on his beat, and immediately went to fetch an ambulance cart. PC Lamb shut the gates to Duffield's yard to ensure nobody escaped, and examined the rooms of the working men's club, checking the hands and clothes of all the club members still inside. He then inspected the two lavatories in the yard, the cottages across the road, and the workshop of sack manufacturer Walter Hindley opposite the yard. Dr. Blackwell, who lived nearby, arrived at 1:15 a.m. and pronounced the woman dead. Her throat had been deeply slashed, cut through, right down to the blood vessels, and her windpipe had been severed. Here's his report.
The deceased was lying on her left side. Her legs were drawn up, her feet 3 yards from the gateway. Her dress was unfastened at the neck. The neck and chest were warm, as were the legs and face. The hands were cold. The right hand was open and on the chest and was smeared with blood. The left hand, lying on the ground, was partially closed, holding a small packet of cashews wrapped in tissue paper. There were no rings nor marks of rings on her hands. The appearance of the face was quite placid. The mouth was slightly open. The deceased had round her neck a check silk scarf, the bow of which was turned to the left and pulled very tight.
By cashew, he didn't mean nuts, but a type of lozenge used to sweeten the breath.
In the neck there was a long incision exactly corresponding to the lower border of the scarf, commencing on the left side, nearly severing the vessels, and cutting the windpipe completely in two. The blood was running down the gutter into the drain in the opposite direction of the feet. There was about 1 pound of clotted blood close by the body and a stream all the way to the back door of the club.
He surmised that her attacker had grabbed hold of her scarf and pulled her backwards with it before cutting her throat. At around 1:45 a.m, Inspector Edmund Reed and Superintendent Arnold arrived on the scene. At 4:30 a.m, the body was removed to the mortuary. By 5 to 6 a.m, PC Lamb was washing the blood away, and Inspector Abberline arrived and ordered a house-to-house search in Berners Street, which turned up nothing. Inspector Reed went to the mortuary and took a description of the victim.
She was around 42 to 44 years old, between 5'2" and 5'5". She was lean and slightly built. She had curly dark brown hair, attractive features, a straight nose, an oval face with light grey or blue eyes, and a pale complexion. Her upper front teeth were missing. She wore a black crepe bonnet and a long black jacket trimmed with black coney fur. The left side was plastered with mud. A single red rose amidst maidenhair fern was pinned to it. She wore an old long black skirt, a dark brown velvet bodice, 2 light serge petticoats, a white chemise, white stockings, side spring boots, and a checked silk neckerchief. Inside a pocket in her underskirt was a padlock key, two pocket handkerchiefs, a piece of lead pencil, a comb, a broken piece of comb, and a metal spoon. There were six large buttons, and also a small one, a dress hook, a piece of muslin, some wool on card, one or two small pieces of paper, and a thimble.
This list evokes a certain sadness, the image of a woman with so little in life that all her worldly goods were carried in her pocket, and that even a broken piece of comb and scraps of wool were kept and treasured. Israel Swartz identified her as the woman he had witnessed being pushed to the ground by the broad-shouldered man at 12:45 a.m. Her name was Elizabeth Stride, and just like all the other victims, she was an individual with a unique story who deserves to be remembered. She was born Elizabeth Gustaf's daughter on a farm near Gothenburg, Sweden, on November the 27th, 1843. So she was 44 at the time of her death. She was the second of four children, and at 16 she moved out of the family home to work as a domestic servant. We know from Gothenburg police records that she turned to prostitution a couple of years later. In April 1865, aged 22, she gave birth to a stillborn daughter. She came to England in 1866, maybe to start a new life for herself after inheriting some money from her mother when she died. That year she registered in London with the Swedish Church at St George in the East, near the Ratcliffe Highway, the scene of several barbaric murders in 1811, which are covered in a previous episode. She spoke both English and Yiddish quite well. In 1869, she married carpenter John Stride, and they ran a coffee house together for 5 years. Everything seemed to be going smoothly until their marriage fell apart in the 1880s. Around this time she went by the nickname Long Liz, possibly a play on words with the phrase Long Stride, due to her surname. In 1878, there was a terrible accident in the Thames when two steamships collided, the Princess Alice and the Bywell, with more than 600 lives lost. Liz later claimed that her husband and two children were killed in this disaster, and that she had an injury to the roof of her mouth from being kicked in the face while climbing the mast to escape. But there's no evidence she had any other children after her stillborn daughter, and records show her husband died in 1884 of heart failure. After Liz was killed in 1888, the post-mortem found no damage to her palate, so it seems this story might have been told to gain sympathy when seeking financial aid from the church. Liz drifted around Whitechapel, spending time in the workhouse, at the infirmary, being treated for bronchitis, and at various lodging houses. In 1885, she began a relationship with dock labourer and army reservist Michael Kidney. They struggled financially, and the clerk at the Swedish church said he had known Liz for 17 years and that she often applied to them for help. She made money through sewing, casual prostitution and charring, an old-fashioned word for cleaning or domestic work. Michael Kidney gave her money when he could afford it. Their relationship was not a stable one, and in 1887 Liz accused Kidney of assaulting her, but for some reason she didn't appear in court, so the charges were dropped. Between 1887 and 1888, they were both arrested multiple times for drunkenness. Kidney last saw Liz on Tuesday, September the 25th, just 5 days before her death. He'd expected her home, but wasn't surprised when she didn't come, as she often left and then returned. He said,
"She always returned without me going after her. I think she liked me better than any other man."
On this occasion, she'd taken a room in a lodging house at 32 Flower and Dean Street, one of the worst, most dangerous streets in Whitechapel. She told fellow lodger Catherine Lane that she'd exchanged words with the man she was living with, and that that was why she'd moved out, although Kidney later denied there'd been an argument. The next day, Dr. Thomas Bernardo visited the lodging house and met Liz Stride. Now, you might recognise the name Barnardo, as it's now a children's charity, but Thomas Barnardo was the man behind it. He was radical and ahead of his time, shocked and moved by the poverty he saw in the East End. He set up homes to care for children without families, and by the time he died in 1905, the charity had 96 homes, caring for more than 8,500 vulnerable children, including those with physical and learning disabilities. The year that Jack the Ripper left his bloody mark on London, Dr. Barnardo was there visiting. Implausibly, he would later become a suspect himself, put forward with other ludicrous suggestions like Lewis Carroll, the author of the Alice in Wonderland books. But he was too old to be the killer and was a philanthropist, not a deadly assassin. Barnardo noticed when he entered the kitchen at 32 Flower and Dean Street that the women there were scared as they discussed the recent murders. One cried out,
"We're all up to no good. No one cares what becomes of us. Perhaps some of us will be killed next."
Her words would transpire to be disconcertingly prescient. On Saturday, September the 29th, the day before her death, Lestrade cleaned some of the rooms at Flower and Dean Street lodging house for sixpence, paid by the deputy, Mrs. Tanner. The two women went to the Queen's Head pub together at around 6:30 p.m. for a drink. At 11 p.m, two labourers named Gardner and Best were about to enter the Bricklayers Arms pub, not far from Berner Street, when they saw a woman with a short man, who had a dark moustache and sandy-coloured eyebrows, wearing a billycock hat, as another name for a bowler hat. They then later identified this woman as Lestrade. Liz and the man were exiting the pub, but seemed reluctant to leave the warmth and venture outside into the rain, and they appeared to be canoodling. And they went off in the direction of Commercial Road and Berner Street. But Gardner and Best may not be reliable witnesses, as they weren't interviewed by the police or called to the inquest. Even if their story was true, it was 2 hours before the murder, making it less likely that the man she was with was her killer. At 11:45 p.m, William Marshall, who lived at 64 Berner Street, was standing outside his house and noticed Liz with a man in the doorway of number 68, just a few doors down. The pair then walked down the middle of the road. The lighting was dim, so Marshall couldn't see the man's face. He heard the man say, "You would say anything but your prayers." Matthew Packer, who sold fresh produce and sweets from the window of his house at 44 Berner Street, claimed that a man and a woman bought grapes from him sometime between 11 p.m. and midnight, but he's since been proven to be lying, as his story was embellished over time, and the post-mortem report confirmed that Liz hadn't eaten grapes before her death, and any stories about her clutching fruit stalks when she was found have been fabricated. At around midnight, a Saturday the 29th of September gave way to Sunday the 30th, William Marshall went back into his house. Between midnight and 1 a.m, various people were coming and going from the Working Men's Club in Duffield Yard. PC William Smith, whose beat took him down Berner Street every half an hour, noticed Lestrade and a man at around 12:30. He described him as 5'7", about 28 years old, wearing a dark coat, a deerstalker hat, and carrying a parcel wrapped in newspaper, about 18 inches long, and 6 inches wide, very specific. The pair were speaking quietly and appeared sober, but he didn't see the man's face. Fanny Mortimer, also a resident of Berner Street, was standing outside between midnight and 1 a.m. She reported seeing a man walking down the road carrying a black shiny bag, which is probably the first story that sowed the seed of the Gladstone bag myth. Many films and pictures portray Jack the Ripper as carrying one of these. A bit like the bags doctors used to transport the tools of their trade. But there was never any evidence for this, and the man Mrs. Mortimer saw turned out to be a harmless tobacco salesman. At around 12:35, she heard the measured, heavy stamp of a policeman passing the house on his beat. Although this hasn't been confirmed, this was probably PC William Smith walking past, as his own estimation of the timing roughly matched. 12:35 a.m, Maurice Eagle, who had led the socialist debate that night at the Working Men's Club, returned to Duffield Yard after walking his girlfriend home. He heard singing in Russian from the first floor of the club, but saw nobody. Around this time, dock labourer James Brown passed the junction of Berner Street and Fairclough Street on his way to get some supper and saw a woman leaning against a wall, talking with a man who was 5'7", wearing a long black coat down to his heels. He heard the woman say,
"Not tonight, some other night."
It was too dark to see much, and it's possible it wasn't Stride at all. But if it was, could this have been the same man that Israel Swartz saw at about that time, pulling Liz to the ground? Although his description didn't seem to match. If all the witness testimonies are to be believed, Liz had been seen with several men that night, all of them of varying appearance. It's possible the witnesses were all seeing different people, although it was apparently unusual to see couples walking down Berner Street. So perhaps it's more easily explained by the theory that they weren't remembering the details accurately. Memories can be affected by many factors, including the power of suggestion by the press. American cognitive psychologist Elizabeth Loftus has extensively researched human memories and proven how easy it is to make people believe they saw something that they didn't. I talk about this in more detail in a bonus episode on Patreon, about an unbelievable case of mistaken identity, which led to changes to the British justice system. Another thing to point out is that Israel Swartz had a good reason to recall his encounter that night, as he was the only witness who saw a man pushing Stride to the ground. The others didn't see anything so shocking, which is probably one of the reasons why Swartz is considered the only reliable witness of that night. In a quirk of chance, a woman at the inquest named Mrs. Malcolm was convinced the deceased was in fact her sister, Elizabeth Watts. Funnily enough, she shared her first name with Stride. Both were nicknamed Long Liz, had at one time kept coffee houses, were prone to drink, and had lived in common lodging houses in the East End, and both had lost their front teeth. Despite these bizarre similarities, it was proven beyond doubt that the body was Elizabeth Stride and not Mrs. Malcolm's sister. Liz was buried a week later, on Saturday, 6th of October, in the East London Cemetery, and a simple funeral was paid for by the parish. So was she really killed by Jack the Ripper? Well, there are several key differences between her murder and those of the other canonical victims. She wasn't strangled. She was the only victim found south of Commercial Road. She was the only victim not found on her back. Other murders were at quieter locations, whereas this one was right in front of the International Working Men's Club, with many more witnesses. The kind of knife she was killed with was different and less sharp than the ones used on the other victims. Surgeon George Baxter Phillips observed that the way Stride's throat was cut was very different from how Annie Chapman's was cut, with the latter being severed all round down to the vertebral column, with an obvious attempt to separate the bones. Most tellingly of all, there was no mutilation of Stride's body like the other victims. Some people believe he simply ran out of time and had to abandon the murder after cutting her throat, not having the opportunity to slash her body like the others, as he heard someone coming, Deemshoots, in his pony and trap. But the Ripper was used to working quickly and in the dark, and it seems an odd place to choose to kill someone if your main goal is to enjoy mutilating the body after death and remove organs. It just wasn't private enough. Many Ripperologists now believe that Stride's death was more likely the result of a domestic dispute, perhaps with partner Michael Kidney. She hadn't been home for 5 days, so is it possible he went out looking for her, and an argument escalated into violence? Could he have been the man who Israel Swartz saw standing in the gateway to Duffield's Yard, throwing Liz Stride to the ground? It seems hard to believe that if the man he saw wasn't the killer, that she was then attacked just minutes later by another man. Modern policing methods teach us that nearly half of all murdered women are killed by their partner, and in about a third of those cases, there'd been an argument just before the homicide took place. We know that Stride and Kidney had a difficult relationship, and she'd moved into a lodging house just a few days before. In an appalling echo of the murder, A woman named Sarah Brown had her throat cut by husband John Brown in the West End of London that same night. Kidney felt he could have done a better job than the police, admitting at the inquest to a run-in at the police station.
When I went to the station, I was intoxicated. I told the inspector at the station that if the murder occurred on my beat, I'd shoot myself. I've been in the army. I believe I could catch the man if I had the proper force at my command. If I was to place the men myself, I could capture the murderer. He would be caught in the act.
The police and the press firmly believe that Liz Stride was a Ripper victim. But in the midst of the Autumn of Terror, it would have been impossible for them to step back and think anything else, caught up in the hysteria of the string of unsolved brutal murders. I wonder if she'd been killed earlier in the year, perhaps before Martha Tabram, whether police would have retrospectively counted her among Jack the Ripper's victims, linking her to the other murders. Some still believe Stride really was a Ripper victim, but most serious students of the case are adamant that she wasn't. The reason many believed her murder was a hastily aborted Ripper killing became clear that very same night when another body was found at 1:45 a.m. in a corner of dark and eerie Mitre Square.
You're not going to stop there, are you? Keeping us all on tenterhooks?
I'm afraid so. This is all we have time for today, as I wanted to dedicate a full episode to each of the victims out of respect, rather than trying to fit both Liz Stride and Catherine Eddowes into one, just because they were murdered on the same night. But I'll be back again to continue the story very soon.
Well, you've made my shift pass quickly. I'll say that. Have another lemonade on the ass. I don't think I'll sleep well tonight, though.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to part 4 of this Jack the Ripper series. If you enjoyed it, please leave me a review or get in touch. You can tweet me at Prash's Murder Map, visit PrashasMurderMap.com or email me on PrashasMurderMap@gmail.com. Don't forget, if you can't wait for this next instalment, this entire mini-series is already available to my Patreon supporters. So if you'd like to get access, I'll include a link in the show notes. Thanks everyone for your support. Join me again next time as we examine the gruesome death of Catherine Eddowes, killed less than an hour after Liz Stride. Until then, take care, everyone.